You're listening to On the Same Page, a podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library.
Welcome back to another episode of On the Same Page. We are your hosts. I'm Abby.
And I'm Katie. We're librarians at the Central Library.
For this episode, we've got a recording of an event that took place at the Northside Library during March, with acclaimed local singer-songwriter Devin Sproul and poet Laura Eve Ingle performing their work.
But before we get to that, we've got book chat.
All right, book chat. Okay. Katie, what did you read?
So I recently read a new book by a debut author. It's called The Falconer by Dana Chapnick.
Okay.
And so it's kind of a crossover novel. It's one of those that's sort of presented as an adult book, mm-hmm. but it could go for a young adult or adult.
Okay,
so it's a coming-of-age story. It's set in 1993 in the Upper West Side of New York.
Which is historical fiction.
Exactly. Yeah, historical fiction, too. Uh-huh. So it touches everything. So it's based on this 17-year-old girl named Lucy Adler. Uh-huh. And so she's in this transitional period where, you know, she's starting to think about colleges. And,
sure.
But she's also experiencing a lot of, like, rites of passage things, like her first love and mm-hmm. things like that. So it's centered on, I guess, her two loves, which first is basketball. She's a phenomenal basketball star in her high school. And then their second love is her best friend, who doesn't know that she has feelings for him.
Okay.
So it's a coming-of-age story where mm-hmm. she's kind of figuring out, okay, what am I going to do with my future? But it's also more about... the author kind of tries to portray the early 90s in New York City. And so she's talking about, you know, like her generation and what this means. It's right before the internet period sort of booms and explodes. And also about what a woman should be like. Because I think it's an interesting time period where you have, like, I guess it would be the third wave of feminism.
Yeah,
so you've got, like, these really militant feminists who are, like, anti-pornography. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have, like, these artists, these, like, bohemian artists who are, like, you know, free love and all about, you know, sex positive and body positive. And she's sort of in between the two. She doesn't know where she fits in with those.
Cool.
So it was a great story. There's a lot of comparisons to J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, where she's sort of like a female Holden Caulfield.
Interesting.
But it also reminded me a lot of, like, Jacqueline Woodson's Another Brooklyn.
Okay, yeah.
Because it's really lyrical, the way she writes. So it kind of falls in between those two.
I am very intrigued.
That's really good.
That sounds great. I read one that is definitely a young adult novel. I read Dream Country by Shannon Gibney. And this one, I didn't remember what it was when I picked it up, because I had checked it out and returned it and put it back on hold and checked it out again. So by the time I finally read it, I'd completely forgotten what it was. But it came out last year, and it's sort of almost like a family saga in reverse. So it's told in sort of vignettes, and each one is from a generation prior or two generations prior to the one you just read a story about. So it starts with like a teenage Liberian immigrant to the United States. And there's, like, he's really kind of living in this identity that's hard to figure out, because I think he was a young child when they came to the States. So being an immigrant, and then you go back a generation, and it's somebody growing up in Liberia, but sort of reflecting on having one grandparent who was Congolese instead of Liberian, and then, you know, you go back further and further until finally you're meeting an ancestor who had been enslaved in the United States and then became a colonist in Liberia when freed slaves or people who had been slaves were freed and sent back to Africa, even if they hadn't been born in mm-hmm. Africa. And that was very interesting because the author was sort of interrogating what that looked like when they were first colonizing Liberia, where people already lived. They were sort of recreating the same kind of oppressive systems that they had just escaped. So now the colonists were taking on servants who were local people and not necessarily being paid. And so it was a very interesting look at, I think, a part of American and sort of, I guess, global American history, if that makes sense, or African American, like diasporic history.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say that? Is that a word that works?
Yeah.
Like a diasporic history, and it was just a very interesting look at the way oppressive systems recreate themselves, but also how complex it is to be, to have any sort of like Liberian identity just because of the way that part of Africa has existed and changed over the last couple hundred years. So that was a really interesting one. I think I learned a lot about Liberia that I had never considered before.
That sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
Kind of similar to that, is it homegoing?
Yeah.
Yeah, but sort of in reverse. Yeah. So that's interesting that she kind of flipped the order around.
And because it was for young adults, it was very accessibly written, so
good.
A little easier for me to follow, I think.
Great.
So next up, we hear a recording of an event that took place at the Northside Library on Tuesday, March 19th. We hear from two artists, Devin Sproul, an acclaimed local singer-songwriter, and poet Laura Eve Engel. They each perform selections of their own work.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Still not very good. thank you all for coming out tonight. My name is Evan Stankovic, Adult Programming Librarian here at the Northside Library, and we're delighted to have with us singer-songwriter Devin Sproul and poet from Brooklyn, Laura Eve Engel. And this program is being audio recorded for the JMRL podcast on the same page, which is accessible through jmrl.org. So definitely check that out. Devin Sproul's music is North American music with weirdo roots, those are her words, Louisa County. Since 2007, her recordings have been released by British label Tin Angel Records, and her tours have taken her all over the U.S. and Canada to Australia, Kenya, Estonia, and beyond. In 2017, she released The Gold String, a collection of songs recorded in her birth country, Canada. She has been married to producer Paul Carreri for 12 years, and the two live with their daughter, Ray, in Fry's Spring. When home, Devin teaches songwriting and guitar to adults and kids at the front porch in downtown Charlottesville. Laura Eve Engel is the author of Things That Go, Octopus Books, which is available for purchase, as are some recordings by Devin Sproul after this program. She's the recipient of fellowships from the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center, the Wisconsin Institute for Creative Writing, and the Helen Wurlitzer Foundation. Her work can be found in The All, Best American Poetry, Boston Review, The Nation, Pen America, Tin House, and elsewhere. She's also a musician. She'll be playing a little this evening, if I understand correctly. Yes, okay. And she's in a band called The Old Year. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome. We're going to start off with Laura Eve Engel.
Hello. Hometown. Hi. Oh, it's really nice. Hello. Wow. Hi. So I'm from Brooklyn in the sense that I live in an apartment there with my partner who is also from Charlottesville, and I am also from Charlottesville, and I grew up here, and it is just it feels like it when I look into this room and see the people that I see, some of whom I haven't seen in many years, and it's incredibly touching just to note who comes out for what kind of event. I just published this book. I didn't publish it. A whole lot of people helped me publish it. Octopus Books, namely. It came out a couple of months ago, and since then I've been living a life that is more involved in the like the public presentation of this thing that I've been working on in quiet for a very long time, and that experience has been utterly moving to note who comes out to be in the same room with you while you do the public side of the work that you do in private. So what you guys are doing sitting in these seats is incredibly meaningful to me, and I'm sure also to Devin. And being here with Devin is exceptionally meaningful for me because I started going to see her perform when I was 14. And I would go to so many of her shows that I thought for sure that she was thinking, who is this freaking kid who keeps coming on my shows? Because I went to a lot, and it's just wonderful to be able to be here and to get to hear her soon, and that we can do this together means a lot to me. we're going to sort of split it up and do, I'll read for about 20 minutes, and then Devin's going to play for about 20 minutes, then we'll take a break, and then we'll come back, and I might play some, I play a little music as well, largely thanks to this lovely human in the back of this room who inspired me a lot when I was a teenager. But I will play a couple tunes and read some more poems, and then Devin will play some more tunes, and then that's the evening. So I'm going to share some poems with you from this book. One thing that I was really taken with in the writing of this book and just in my life is the American Southwest, which is a landscape that just is wholly remarkable to me. I didn't think I was a person who was all that interested in beauty until I went out to the Southwest, and I saw just the landscape there was a thing that made me want to sort of sit down and contemplate beauty a lot. But this poem is called Home on the Range. There are times where no one else exists. They are more like places. I love the great American West, where the moon hunts us for a living. It draws closer and then away from me. Me, where I cannot be stopped. Under the moon's shadow stalk, where time encounters itself on the mesa, and is rubbed sandpapery by its own imitable processes. I am, with an increasing frequency, becoming. I'm out thinking of wind in a low presence of wind, bending to stir the scrub and sage that attends the heart's climb from ridge to ridge. Of feelings, of course. The past must be a jerk. All those bonfires, dead dogs, a herd of horizons with me at its back. I nip and I nip. And yet, wherever I go, I find myself on my knees before a feeling so big, it's already been annexed by the military. Being in love is like almost knowing what is about to happen before you are ripped apart by the sun and its belly. Like finally finding inside a haystack, there's a more beautiful haystack. From what did love all of a sudden rear up? Or the knife in my hand, where having one means I believe in my life, in the language of what it might become. This is called The Lake is Burning. To describe anything is to imply a presence, as in, there is within. You are a warmth the bad night draws itself around. Light lands elsewhere, makes a museum of this flickering room, where it was once a topography of pleasures. Today was a topography of weather. The wind, the stance of the trees, arguing with chatter that moves horizontally like traffic over the event of people moving toward their cars. Conversation shares almost nothing with the vertical trees, more with cars moving toward their homes, where the light divides dinner from its being eaten, a set table still in its intentions from its intentions. The meat is warm, and it is unmoving. If anything's been learned today about today, whether or not the best part is cleaning up after yourself without fanfare, no one's saying. Who sees water on its best and only behavior moving toward the lower ground? You're never all the way into sleep when the news arrives and requires you. If you're lucky, it's an old love's arm in your hair. You're happiest just before you know the area around the lake is burning. It's nothing like old bad love everywhere. So warm you can see it. But maybe a little like it, too. Far off and terrifying. Is that a whistle? Or do I have tinnitus? So one large theme that runs through this book is the idea of what happens when we look at stuff. That's something that I feel is kind of a role that I play in the world as a watcher, and I think a lot of us are playing that role, or it's one of the many roles that we play. In particular, the idea that runs through this book that I'll talk about a bit later is through the figure of Lot's wife in the Bible and what happened to her when she looked at the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. She turned into a pillar of salt. And I think that we have a lot of opportunities to look at destruction on a massive scale now more than we ever have in some ways, that the opportunity to do that lives in our pockets, it lives on our laptops, we get notifications and we're invited to see things or look at things that are destructive on a massive scale or intimate. Violence that's intimate, but because it's mediated by technology, becomes this sort of distant thing that we can almost look at as if it's entertainment. So there's a lot of stuff in this book about looking, and here's one that's not so heavy as all that, but we'll get a little heavier later. This is called Frames. Say we begin with things I say I see. There's a house. Then, to smooth out the part where I think I'm not being clear, I cut my bangs to see clearly more over there. So that house will look less like a house with hair out front. I can sit here with this face to try to make my looking clear. Looking's hard to look like. From possible faces, I can choose squint, which is narrow and hurts, and things are lost in the vision field. Who made vision a field? Who built that house to look like a house with bangs in the way? Say I address you, sometimes curator of the unmown yard or whatever. Say I tell you I see, but what for, is a way to get at you saw dandelions when I said field and meant buildings. I heard a small whisper, that's why I left. I heard a small whisper of the word bangs, and it made me realize in that moment, why do we call them that? Bangs, it is a weird word. This poem is called View From Here. Reflections of my favorite buildings on the water waver, look up at me with a sadness. The sun readies itself for today's tourists and costs nothing. On the 11th floor, working away at my things, I cost a little bit, even though mostly my things are wondering why we say floor when we mean to say this building lets us work away at our things from the sky. The sky, with pretty much impunity. Meaning, I get to walk around most days not noticing I'm not falling, so I'm free to notice how the lake catches and then makes tremble every last solid it sees. When I hear that some others are unhappy with maintaining the road I take to get here, I want to say, who pumped you so full of melancholy and fed you to the barnyard animals? Haven't you noticed we're up in the sky? Thank you for... Even the ones of you that I haven't met personally, and it's unfair because so many of you I have, I can tell that you're a good audience because you're dynamic and moving and making sounds and things. Sometimes poetry readings can be very quiet. This is much nicer, in my opinion. So I'm going to read a bit of a longer one, which I like to warn people just because it's longer. So I'll pause. There are section breaks, and I'll pause in between. But this one, sort of in the vein of looking at things, this is a longer piece that interacts with a work of land art by Walter de Maria, who I feel as if from the nods people are familiar with him. One of the many things that he did as an artist was to create something called the Lightning Field out in Catron County, New Mexico, and... the lightning field is, the concept of the lightning field is sort of explained in this poem, but it basically is a place where people go and they wait in a field of metal poles that are all the same height. And these metal poles are separated, I think, by, it's like a mile by a mile or something. It's a huge grid of metal poles, and it's designed to be sort of a series of lightning rods. And you're supposed to go there in New Mexico and wait for the lightning. I had never been there when I wrote this poem. I've since been there, but this at the time when I wrote it was total speculation. And just a really real curiosity and fascination with the idea of this having been constructed. And it's still out there, and you can still go, and I absolutely recommend going. It is a really, really unusual and interesting experience and very beautiful. This is called the Lightning Field. In the desert, there's a field where people go to be beside themselves waiting for lightning. Mm-hmm. To wait for the lightning in a field sown with metal poles. I have this only kind of visual idea. In it, I'm a pole that waits for a real feeling to pull in a downward motion towards me, like a tapestry or sword. I collect the times during a day I pretend to be in the act of knowing. In what I become while in the act of knowing, I am urgent, like a pole. All day, warnings have been ringing out the flat gray air, but I know what the weatherman is really saying. That I may be a monument to my own investigating whatever I want. The weather is a worthy adversary. It knows what it'll all be like come morning. But it's here one way or the other, this lightning field in the desert mallow. But ever I am arriving at the present moment, bearing a great distance in mind. Even inside this sense of the great elemental, there's time to be a tourist. I can remember every time another person's asked me if I'm doing okay while I'm chugging a large container of diet soda in my element. And I can always be okay in a carnival kind of situation. There's even time to think of love, though perhaps this isn't. I can eat a corn dog. Who was it who said, no matter where you are, you can always smell the smell of the sea? When in a fish-out-of-water type state, a person will sometimes say, no matter where she is, she can always smell the smell of the sea. Quote, it too burns the edges of the land, end quote. When there are no people for miles, my heart slows for the sand, which is granular and invisible, unless there's a lot of it in one place, like people. Before I arrived, there were two of me in the car. Here I am, eager to discover the sight of a future splitting the sky into its parts. To what do I owe the pleasure? I think at the shadows explaining the shifting sky. It bears the mark of outside forces, the decisions of wind projected on sand, the tiny weatherman living in what I know whenever I know anything about the weather. There come with the body and the moment, of course, all kinds of limitations. Having only one of them, for example, and the issue of where they go when I'm not looking. Sometimes I call things other than what they are, but maybe in the morning I will once again escape blame. My involvement with the lightning field isn't straightforward. Like the evening, evenly spaced over the mesa, a combination of time and events delivered me. I'm looking to be planted evenly in the deep evening, then reached for by the warm sum of its details. Could a pane of glass come to rest evenly on these details? Their origins, concrete among the aster. Apricot mallow, purple aster, broom. Anyway, there must be a light that cries out to be carried from one place to another by what you see is possible. When my mind bends again towards the sky, it's barely a skin on this earth. Just a thought remaining of the old books altogether. When I can barely remember the desert, I can remember I lost the urge to see my own face, and that the lightning field did not find me buried like an egg under a warm, heavy sky and lift me up. Taking aim over the long-held breadth of the plain, it didn't river down, transform the ground into golden soldiers. Light makes the desert look like the known desert. Illuminated on the plain in a series of events that refuses to conform to my sense of how long an observed event should last, the white dunes crest the view. Something known is locked inside my body. My favorite part about the tenderness part is that it is unnecessary. Often it's proper to think of an ending, then start there. This isn't the hard part. No one's saying what that is. A sky grown half wild, as if with hair, makes the mind red. I've gone desperate wild, or I don't mind the tenderness present in saying it. Like gawking from the car at too many cows in one pen makes me sad on the long drive away from the lightning field. Too many cows grazing openly will resist this little inference about suffering. The old heifers were never wrong either. Where reason, the color of hay, may burst open near the road. The hay light spilling open. Any moment may be the one where I catch myself beside what I went into that field for and would again. Not today. There are so many different instances of time in one animal. Like an unvisited thought, a voice suddenly breaks through and tumbles towards the ground. It could be mine. And I'll read one more tiny one, and then I'm really very excited to hear some tunes by Ms. Devin Strolk. This is called You Love Desperately and Like a Raft. You love desperately and like a raft, the clear water that holds up your boat. The water was clearly built to buoy the boat. It's like how TV shows buoy the dead. After they've died, there they are. Their kind faces float just out of reach, like a rescue. Like that tiny island. I promise I'm not making this up. Today the world is full of people who are dead, and also you are in it. By all accounts, everyone everywhere should be drowning. There's tons of water all over, and only a few ideas about how to stay dry and out of it. From your raft, the smell of the water is patient, which for now is enough to love it, which for now is helping. Thank you. It is my very great pleasure, I feel like I'm bucket listing, to introduce to you Ms. Devin Sproul.
Well, maybe I am used to music shows, but I feel like we need to do just a little more clapping for Laura Eve Engel. After the first poem, I was like...
And I got it. And I felt cool for getting it.
I'm a little nervous. I haven't played in a while, and I had a great day, but it was not spent preparing, at least in a traditional sense. I did some practicing yesterday, but today I went to the Gordon Avenue Library with my daughter, and I had a beautiful walk with some friends and my daughter, and went to the playground. So I'm going to play a short Leonard Cohen song, just because sometimes it's like... playing a cover song for me feels like if you know you're gonna have to take off all your clothes in front of, like, if I was like, oh God, I know I'm gonna have to take off all my clothes in front of these people, what am I gonna take off first. Playing a Leonard Cohen song is like starting with my shoes. That's not how I feel right now, but I do feel, you know, it is a vulnerable thing. You got me singing. Feels that, like I'm feeling it. My name is Devin Sproul, and I live in Fry Spring, and right by the train, and I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for being here. Song. I wrote it when I was 18 and my brain moved so fast then. There's a lot of words, but I'm going to just tumble on in. This is like the shirt. Hey, just because we're in a library and John Paul is here, we all take off our clothes sometimes to put on our favorite reindeer PJs, for instance. My daughter is now. Reindeer! If my ears hear a sigh of a shiny red violin, clear by the Ravenna down in the Blue Ridge, by the dog bags and trash, by the bottles and cash and the dead meat, brown grass and the packed dirt in the Blue Ridge, and my home must be around another good old Virginia block. On the cello solo, then a double stopping bow from my headphones in the Blue Ridge. I'm walking at noon, appearing under the white of the daytime moon, keeping my just another born kid in the Blue Ridge. It's all to make a pattern of love, to roost a lava field of white doves with just a pitchfork and a pair of thick gloves for your whole life in the Blue Ridge. The pick up and go, the grunt check call, the gleam of your white underclothes in the backseat in the Blue Ridge. The pile of bacon by a couple fried eggs, kiss marks and hearts on the picnic table leg. The quartet fretting on up in my head on my long walk through the Blue Ridge. And my home comes up around another good old Virginia. Try this one. I went on a songwriting retreat in Texas. It was all women, 12 women, for a week. It was, well, 5 days. It was wonderful, super intense. I had been nursing before that for a couple of years, and I was just like, oh, whatever happens is fine, you know, and if we start back up, if we don't, or whatever. Such an optimist. It was super intense. We did end up weaning, but I didn't know going into it, like, what was going to happen. So for anyone who has ever been in this situation, everyone has a different journey, and, you know, this counts for dads, too. I was like, well, I guess this is what I'm writing about, because mostly that's what happens, is whatever's kind of right in front of me gets the song. So the song is called Up to Us. Remember it. Anything crazy, too loud or too quiet? Funny, I keep having these, because I am such an avid and frequent library patron these days with my daughter, particularly a lot of Gordon Ave, is close to our house, but we come up here a lot and have done some we're all always here and there and downtown at the Central Library, and I keep looking out and I keep on being like, oh, is that like a famous local, you know, I've seen, and then I'll be like, oh, I'm at the library. These aren't the librarians that I've seen. Some people who I recognize. You know. Which is such an honor to, you know, it says a lot about where you work when you go back there. It's up to us how we're gonna do this. Pull out the stool, put away the bucket. I'll keep it safe for a while in case we change our minds. When we were new, I was always afraid I wouldn't have enough. However much I so good. Holy cow, look at us now. After all that fuss, it was up to oh. one place. Don't call yourself by only one name. Even when I let you go, you can always come back home. Come and be a woman with me. Even in the fire, even in the water, even as it rises, even as we're dying, holy man, I know we can. We have got the guts. It's up to us.
As soon as I saw it, I just felt so artistically inspired and just like, you know, I hope you don't mind, I posted it to Instagram from the bathroom right before the show, and I was like, tonight is going to be cosmic. And I just feel like that artwork, like bringing that artwork to this artwork and to Laura Eve's artwork to, you know, it just like added an extra shot of art to the night, which... So thank you, Evan, for all of that and just for being laid back and easy to work with, which is the big glue that makes it all worth it. Speaking of that, and the bio that you read so nicely that I sent you, it mentioned a record called The Gold String, which is about love and connection, you know, via art, but also just via love and... So the title track from that record is also called The Gold String, and I'd love to try playing that for you now. Yeah, maybe we'll take a break after this one. You know, nothing crazy, 10 or 15 minutes. Please stay if you can, and that way, because we started a little late, and that way it'll be perfect. Got it all under control. Stretcher, I'm energetic.
For Devin, it's lovely. We're hoping you're having a lovely time. Welcome.
Yeah.
Welcome to part two. This is a poem that when I graduated college and I went to UVA, I then worked for a year in the local Department of Social Services on the downtown mall, where I had a colleague who introduced me to this concept that I've remembered for the rest of my life, where she did everything by hand with pencil and paper, and she said it's for job security, because that way if, like, no one else can recreate the things that I've done, and no one knows how I do them, so they can never get rid of me. And I thought about it for years, and it ended up sort of creeping into the title of this poem, which is, I will make a useful manual for my tasks and hide it. I don't owe anybody for the bad thoughts I think or will think. It isn't right, the access this gives me to everything. A person with actual access has access to knives, but not necessarily ways to make more knives. To make more of anything, one must go a long way, across a great distance, past symbolic trees and lush ideas of desert, fences, all the way to where the blades just glint up out of the land and are more or less ripe for the plucking. More or less was never an actual question. When there's more weather outside than inside a building, the building's windows spring big glassy tears. I don't see what good it does, putting it this way. Ours is a history of a breathing building, letting people go to prove it breathes. I'm at work in a building where I draw strange birds to scale, where down the hall a man comes in every day and remembers one day in December in his childhood for a living, until one day he doesn't. Sometimes the sky just opens up. Not everything's allowed. Nobody, for instance, cares very much for my singing voice, but I can spell daffodil however I want. I want to say, I see a great many possibilities for development around the office, which I will call recognizing our potential, which I will call daffodil, which is why you'll keep me for as long as you can, like a pleasant taste at the end of a meal, this new thing our building's about to be about has many spellings I'll travel distances for. So I'm gonna read a shorter little section this time, and then I'm gonna do this totally self-centered and opportunistic thing and play a couple of tunes for you, because it's a dream to be able to do that with Devin, and it's a dream to be able to do that here, and also because music is something I've been taking more seriously in my life of late. So I just wanted to give you the heads up. That's another teacher thing that I learned from Margot Bingham's at the Young Writers Workshop. Let everybody know what's coming. This is a poem that I think of as being associated in some ways with Charlottesville, because when I wrote it, I was thinking about the moment in our country's history and in everyone's personal history when the Columbine shooting occurred. When that happened, I was in eighth grade in Sutherland Middle School. And I just remember very distinctly having this moment of looking at, you know, this, honestly, the sunset over the Fashion Square Mall, and, like, thinking to myself that there are people my age or around my age who aren't going to have those experiences anymore. And it was something that seemed at the time to be remarkable and unusual, and that alone made it tragic, and now we know that it is not remarkable or unusual. So this is called All the Sciences. The year I fail all the sciences, there are many factors, but no one is in any way confused. The radio brimming with everything it knows about some shooters until it gets the shooters down to two. The dead men's rooms reveal nothing about unhappiness. What starts out as reason, refusing to make more of itself, has a way of becoming several mixed reports from the field, where I'm having a feeling of being 11 and watching the sunset. I'm having a feeling of my chest as a trunk full of blankets and answers to questions about who gets to keep a garden. Often enough, we return to the field with trowels, intentional. I'm told this is an American approach to the problem. I've been trying to figure out what it means to have an American approach to a problem. Maybe it's when I think the thoughts I have that don't work hard enough to stick probably weren't deserving of the field, and not when I think the ones that do are lucky. We like to be told what we're doing is difficult, so it's correct that the sky is mostly a flubbed forecast, until the part where it turns to light, or to egg, down the calm sides of a mixing bowl. I remember that to make a solution, something needs to dissolve. Sunsets, the library, the parts we've picked apart with borrowed beaks or tractors. It feels good to get an old thing next to a new thing, because of how sure it is that they'll never turn into each other. Or maybe it's because we like what putting a rock near a rocket says about what we can do in the meantime. Sometimes I like to read backwards until the bullet re-enters its gun, until the dead men remove their heads from the bags and are about to be hungry or can almost remember what they came into that room for or are born. So we'll get a little heavier before we get a little lighter. The poems that I'm not reading from this book are, there's a series of poems that relate to the story of Lot's wife, as I was talking to you about earlier. My book is for sale in the back if you want it. And you can explore that more. I'm not going to read those poems just because it's a long series and they're very long, but I'm really interested, again, in this notion of what happens to us when we look at destruction or violent events. And in this book, one of the things that comes up a couple of times is the specific moment that we all had, the choice that we all had to make one day when these ISIS recruitment videos that depicted the murder of people that they had captured started appearing on the internet. There were journalists who were beheaded. There was, in this case of this poem, a Jordanian Air Force pilot who was captured and burned alive. And we all had these notifications on our phones and in the news where we had the option to watch or not watch. And I have very little judgment with regards to what the better thing to do is. I think it's a predicament that we all have to face and come to terms with, you know, thinking of what we're going to do, what kind of decision we're going to make, and that's sort of the smallest inconvenience that we have relative to the real violence of those events. But it is something that I think about, and I think about the way that whatever we do makes something happen in us. It seems to me that that moment is a bit alchemical, where you change. After you see something violent, you change. And so I'm trying to be somewhat thoughtful about that in this book. And this poem in particular is directly sort of speaking to that and to one of those events in particular. And it's called "I Can Watch a Man in a Cage Get Burned Alive." Muaz Safi Yousef Al-Kasazba, 1988 to 2015. I can watch a man in a cage get burned alive. I can watch his raised hands join at his forehead. I can speculate about a body in prayer. I can watch the orange of his jumpsuit go up. His face, I can make comparisons. I can turn the sound up or off. I can constitutes the first half of a decision, which is often followed by additional considerations and time. It involves the weighing of his hands against alive, against my hands, a speculation about orange, the jumpsuit, the raised cage. If I can watch an orange prayer go up in a man's body, I can never unwatch it. A speculation about who I will be then, after. It's how time works. It doesn't stop working. Sometimes I can't do what I can. And this is another, I think there are a couple people in this room who are in the sciences. And so this one engages with Newton. I'll read it for y'all, anyone interested in science. It's called Appleshot. Watch me. I'm like Newton before he had his big idea. Just a body looking around for something to eat. Suddenly, it's clear how it all falls, how history pulls us all a little lonely towards it, sometimes a little without remorse. Here I am, these two bolts for my crossbow, and no child to threaten or save, still on the prowl for some rich fruit to split in two with my accuracy, or else defend. Or use to describe my predicament, get myself banned forever from the garden. I'm afraid I'm no good defense against anything. Not the weeds gone wild in the garden, not the blades hidden in their apple costumes, not our ancestry. A girl full of apples is nothing but a girl and a belly and a concern for how things will shake out. How can I ever be two enough to eat and eat? So I'm going to do one more poem and then play some tunes, which makes me feel more anxious than anything else. I think playing music's real vulnerable. It is like not that I've ever got any experience taking my clothes off in public, but man, I don't even take my shoes off in public most of the time. And this is called Inner Resources, and it owes a debt to a great poem by John Berryman called Dream Song Number 14. If that is unfamiliar to you, it would be a gift to yourself to go read it, and if it's familiar to you, then you'll recognize some language in here. Before I read this too, I want to say thank you to you, Evan, for everything. Devin who I very much enjoyed getting to email both of you is, hey, Evan and Devin. That was, in addition to everything else joyful about this event, that has been incredibly joyful to be able to do. It's just a fun time. But Evan, this is a really exceptionally wonderful thing, and it feels very carefully put together and thoughtfully, beautifully put together. And, you know, thank you. And Lindsay and Northside and everybody. It's a funny thing to be able to show love by setting up a room, and that is exactly what we've done. Inner resources. It feels good to love our country. We must not say so. I'm divided by a love of our millions of brilliant inventions, and how I'll dumbly sniff and rub each one until I've figured out how I can use it for that other thing. Just like a brilliant inventor, I too have a body, so I know everything's invented to pleasure a body. I was born to this country, and all of it was entranced by my tiny fingers, and then I learned where I could put them. Before I was born, there was sniffing and rubbing, and it formed a tiny unity. Already it was getting too big to call by one name. It was becoming a collection of purposes, which is like calling the sky a collection of purposes because stars exist. This is why I write little notes to myself, reminding myself to take all the notes out of my pockets before sleep. One note says, look at the sky. And when I remember to do it, I feel very American. I feel American when I want to be able to rub up against what I'm pretty sure is that planet. Planets exist. They hold the names we gave them inside them like a breath. I need to remember to look up the names of the planets I'm seeing. I'm fairly certain of what I'm seeing. It's too bright to be anything else. So I couldn't be more serious about the fact that Devin's music has really been a tremendous influence on me as a person and as someone who plays music and enjoys it. I was saying to her earlier that we're like quite close in age, and so when I was, I think of myself as being this 14-year-old in the room with you, and looking up at you just like, who is this incredible professional adult person? But I should have just been like, can we be friends with each other? And so now it feels very lovely to be able to say that and to not be such a shy individual.
The guitar looks good on you.
Oh, thank you. Something that I really learned from following you and also Paul Carreri so often was this, like, this hybrid style of playing a kind of, like, jazz standard, either an actual jazz standard or an appreciation, it's something in its lineage, with a folk presentation. And that was really all I ever wanted to do. And I had never heard it before, you guys. And then your influences became my influences, and I started listening to John Fahey and to all these other musicians that I love. So it's very lovely to be able to share some music with you. This is a Vera Lynn song that I adore, called You'll Never Know. Just how much
if you don't know now.
Like you could adjust before you started driving.
Oh yeah.
Or so I'm just gonna play one more tune and then I'm gonna hand it over to you, and I'm very excited. This is a tune so I'm in a band called The Old Year. It feels very funny to say that for the first time in my early 30s that I'm in a band. My buddy who I play with, his name is Paul Eric Lipp, and he's an exceptional musician, and we wrote this together, but it was mostly his work. But it's called Tell Me, and it usually, we're like kind of in electronic configuration, so it sounds very different when we play it, but we're going to do it acoustic this evening, as it were.
It's usually electronic.
Exactly.
You're still standing there where I left you when I
very much. I'll play a song celebrating this new guitar, new old guitar, from one of the records that I did bring. I was just trying to describe them to someone, and this one's title track is called Don't Hurry for Heaven. And it compares the shape of a guitar to the shape of a woman. Not always the same on both sides.
I really want to
play this one. So I'll play this one. We'll be like, is this, or should we? And then, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's totally great.
This has been an amazing night, and it's gone perfectly. And it's like 8:25. We're all going to be like home and reading our books, our fresh Tuesday books.
It's about all those...
super annoying people that are really good at everything they try without even really trying.
This podcast is made possible through generous support from the Friends of the Library. If you'd like to learn more or join the Friends, please head to their website at jmrlfriends.org.
Please hit subscribe wherever it is that you're listening to the podcast. If you have books that you'd like us to read and discuss, or topics that you'd like to hear on a future episode, please email us at podcast@jmrl.org. That's all for us today, but we'll be back in 2 weeks with more content from library events. Thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be
on the same page.